then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, a vocal, push and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more door for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's July the 10th, 2014. Another week has gone by, and we're still waiting for Godot. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Now, last week, I left you guys with a bit of homework. I asked you to read an article or a commentary by a man named Matt Bracken called When the Music Stops. And I gave you the internet link for that. It's a very good article describing in some detail, quite likely prophetic detail, how the balloon might go up, and how that might happen someday soon, i.e. when the EBT system crashes, either through some massive computer glitch, or else because the regime simply runs out of money. Now, there are several other ways it could happen. I, for one, still don't think we need to stop worrying about some damn fool thing in the Middle East regarding Israel and Iran, but Bracken's scenario as laid out in his article is logical and persuasive. Now, please do not think I'm knocking Mr. Bracken. He's a good writer, and he knows his stuff from a military angle. He also is not afraid to address the all-important issue of race, although he does so only gingerly and in passing, and he uses code words like MUIs, minority urban Utes, when he means violent young black savages. But even as far as that goes, he stands head and shoulders above most conservatives and Tea Party types who are still running around looking for black faces to haul up onto the platform at their rallies and meetings to proclaim to the world, see, we're not racists. The worst recent example of this was poor old Cliven Bundy a few months ago filling his Facebook page with pictures of himself surrounded by smiling niggers. But there was something missing in Mr. Bracken's analysis, and it's the same thing that's missing in most paleoconservative and survivalist and soft nationalist writing and thinking. And I asked you guys to read it and see if you could figure out what that missing component is. And many of you did so, and you posted your comments on the Homeland blog, and you brought up some good points. A few of you hit the nail on the head. What's missing from Matt Bracken's analysis is a political dimension and a political or demographic prognosis. Put more simply, Matt Bracken makes the same mistake that conservative commentators and analysts all make. He's all problem and no solution. Now, Matt Bracken treats the coming collapse of the United States as something inevitable, which of course it is, but something more like a natural disaster, such as a hurricane or a tornado or a volcano erupting, unpreventable and insoluble. Now, it's something that's just going to happen one day, and there's nothing anybody can do about it except stock up on guns and ammo and MREs in your garage and wait for the inevitable explosion. And that's how a lot of white people think these days, even if they don't talk about it much. But I believe it's a mistake to take the attitude of just be prepared without some kind of actual political strategy to bring about a change, a revolution in the entire way American society is ordered. Now, the old democratic order, both small d and capital D, is going to collapse. That's certain. Things slipped beyond the point of no return long ago. What exactly is the long-term solution to this horrible mess white people find themselves in? Now, he doesn't seem to have one. The Northwest Front does. Go to northwestfront.org and you can see that solution, up to and including a new constitution for our sovereign white homeland in the Pacific Northwest. Bracken makes another incorrect assumption in his work, or maybe he doesn't and he just didn't spell it out. I don't know. I get the impression that this man knows a good deal more than he's willing to commit himself to in print. There's another problem I have with Matt Bracken's analysis of coming events, and that's what might be called the overall concept. Now, let me choose my words carefully here. I know what I mean, but I'm not quite sure how to convey it. There is a widespread impression among a lot of otherwise switched-on and racially conscious white people that the way this is all going to shake out is a Bracken-like scenario. Minority rioting begins in the inner cities when the welfare checks get cut off. It spreads to the white suburbs when the police lose control and when the hunger for food and alcohol and drugs can no longer be satisfied since all the stores have been looted and burned down in the ghetto. And there is a kind of Mad Max scenario in the suburbs, which Bracken predicts the whites will win, at least tactically. But what then? I think even most alert and aware white people have this idea in the back of their minds that when the balloon goes up, there will be a fairly short period of chaos and bloodshed, but that the natural superiority of whites will assert itself. At long last, we'll be able to go ahead and gun these shitskins down. I think we all look forward to that. But that will be over in a matter of weeks or months, and then somehow the police will come back and reassert control. The electric power will come back on, the TV and the internet will come back on, and having won this brief war, the whole country will begin slowly staggering back towards the good old days of abundance, Six Flags, and the Brady Bunch. That's not going to happen. I'm reminded of the congressmen and senators who followed the 1st Union Army down to Bull Run to watch the spectacle of the hated Southerners getting licked, and some of them ending up in jail in Richmond that night. I'm reminded of all those millions of young men all over Europe who marched off to war a century ago next month, all of them thinking it would be over by Christmas. I think the better commentary from that time was the British Foreign Secretary, Sir Edward Grey, who on the night of August the 4th, 1914, saw the lights of London being turned off or covered up in the city's first blackout since they didn't know if the Zeppelins were on their way. He said, "The lamps are going out all across Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetime." Guys, when it finally does happen, when the balloon goes up and the lights go out, we will not see them turned on again in our lifetime, metaphorically speaking. We need a plan, people. Oh, wait, we have one. It's called the Northwest Imperative.
This is what a loony lefty or a Quaker has said about the Jews. There is a great danger for the United States of America. That danger is the Jew. Gentlemen, in whichever land the Jews have settled, they have depressed the moral level and lowered the degree of commercial honesty. They have created a state within a state, and when they are oppressed, they attempt to strangle the nation financially, as in the case of Portugal and Spain. For more than 1,700 years, they have lamented their sorrowful state, namely that they were driven out of their motherland. But, gentlemen, if the civilized world today should give them back Palestine as their property, they would immediately find pressing reasons for not returning there. Why? Because they are vampires, and cannot live on other vampires. They cannot live among themselves. They must live among Christians and others who do not belong to their race or their religion. At the time of the first Congressional Convention in Philadelphia, Benjamin Franklin said, "If they are not excluded from the United States by the Constitution, within less than 100 years, they will stream into our country in such numbers that they will rule and destroy us, and change our form of government, for which Americans have shed their blood and sacrificed life, property, and personal freedom. If Jews are not excluded, within 200 years, our children will be working in the fields to feed the Jew, while they remain in the counting house, gleefully rubbing their hands. I warn you, gentlemen, if you do not exclude the Jew forever, your children's children will curse you in your grave. A leopard does not change his spots. They should be excluded by the Constitution. Not all Jews practice the Babylonian Talmud, But back in 1776, there was no such thing as Reformed Judaism. Ethiopian and Samaritan Jews have only been recently discovered, who do not practice the Talmud. In the Talmud, it teaches that a Jew is not required to practice morality towards the Gentile. Not to practice morality towards all is utterly stupid. Eventually, the whole world will come to the knowledge of their tribal morality and will come to hate them. The righteous hate the wicked, and no amount of legislation can change that. The population will instead end up hating the politicians who were so stupid as to think you can prevent the righteous from hating the wicked. Jews run Sin City, known as Vegas. Republicans, and that includes Mitt Romney, may as well be bowing down to Satan, because they all went to Vegas to bow down to the richest Jew in Vegas. The Bible calls the Jews the synagogue of Satan. Now, if the Mormons do not excommunicate Mitt Romney for bowing down to Satan, then the reputation of the Mormons will be in the toilet. Years ago, the Catholic Church thought it was above righteousness, for a cardinal said to a German monk, "The Pope is above Scripture." Well, the name of that monk was Martin Luther. The priesthood of the Mormon Church is not above righteousness. And if the leadership of the Mormon Church condones Mitt Romney bowing down to Satan, then thousands of Mormons will abandon the Mormon Church. God or righteousness is no more on the side of the Jew now than it was in 70 AD when the Romans came and destroyed Jerusalem. Christians who have supported the immoral state of Israel have made themselves apostates in the sight of the world, yearning for righteousness. Jews are a bunch of gangsters, the gods of the underworld. Time says it is the time for the revenge of Rachel Corrie. Peace means thou shalt not covet, but Israel has coveted the West Bank and Gaza and even killed an American. Then also, what about the Liberty back during the Six-Day War? Jehovah's Witnesses are a Bible-based religion that believes that the Bible is the Word of God and that the Bible says that the Jews are the synagogue of Satan, whereas the Zionist Christians are listening to money or world events instead of God's words, so in the end, they will prove themselves to be apostates. Global hatred of the Jew is coming. Hitler said, "My spirit shall arise from the ashes of Berlin, and I shall prove to be right."
I've been hearing Mr. Covington speak about the white character issue for some time. I was wanting a definition of what he meant, and I found a list of things I think address this issue. White folk virtues. Courage. My fear does not keep me from defending my folk, my family, or myself. I conquer my fear. Discipline. I control my mind, will, and emotions. I do, of my own accord, what needs to be done. Fidelity. I keep the vows I make, especially those to folk, family, and self. Honor. I keep pure the name and honor of my folk, family, and self. Hospitality. For folk and family, I willingly share my food, hearth, and shelter. Industriousness. I perform my tasks with joy and honor, holding nothing back. Perseverance, I continue until I've met my obligations and my goals. Self-reliance, I support my folk, my family, and myself. I depend only on myself. I strengthen the independence of the folk and family. Truth, I search for and embrace the truth. When speaking the truth may harm my folk or family, I keep silent. Live with courage and honor, comrades.
Now, as most of you know, I spent about 5 years off and on in Ireland, and I'm familiar with the situation there from something besides books and television and Hollywood movies. I play a lot of IRA and Irish nationalist songs on here, much to the disgust of a lot of our British listeners, for reasons that I've explained in the past, mostly having to do with the fact that it's some of the most magnificent folk music that our race has ever produced. However, I also spent some brief time in the north in the six counties, mostly just traveling through. And despite what a lot of our British comrades may think, I'm very much aware that there are two sides to the conflict in Northern Ireland, and that the Protestant Irish consider themselves to be British. I kind of feel sorry for them. They're the only ones who think that. The British say they're Irish, the other Irish say they're Irish, and the rest of the world says they're Irish. Now, this Saturday is what they call the Glorious Twelfth in Northern Ireland. the beginning of the marching season when the Protestant Orange Order and the Apprentice Boys of Derry staged these big parades all over Ulster, marching into the Catholic areas looking for fights. Basically, that's what it is, which they almost always find. Now, the traditional Orange marching band consists of flutes and also these big, huge drums called lambegs. They make a very distinct reverberation, and when you hear about 30 of these things coming down the street, it's a really powerful and impressive sound spectacle, kind of the signature sound of Northern Ireland in many ways. Now, for some years, I've been trying to get some recordings of a really good Orange flute band with proper lambegs, not snare drums, and I haven't been too happy with the results, although I have played some of these pieces on here before. It just doesn't sound right without that big drum. Now, a friend of mine pulled this off YouTube. This is a guy named Willie Drennan doing the opening speech, so you also get to hear the sound of that very distinct Ulster accent. Nothing at all like your Sharon Begorra stage Irish.
The real lambeck drum, you know. As I said, there's always been drums in Ulster right back to ancient times, and the drums kept getting bigger and better and louder until one day in the mid-1800s, near the wee village of Lambeg in County Antrim, someone developed the lambeck drum as it is today. And that was the end of the evolution of the drum, because nobody has been able to improve upon it ever since. And it's something that is only played in Northern Ireland. But someone has suggested to me recently that the reason why it's only played in Northern Ireland is because people in all our countries in the world are not as daft as to walk around carrying such a big heavy drum. But, you know, it's not everybody appreciates the lambeg drum. Where I grew up, I could hear lambeg drums coming for miles around where I live, you know, and just almost any summer night you could hear the drums blare. But, some people just can't handle the lambeg drums at all, and I never understood that, you know, until there a couple of months ago. I was with all the members of the Ulster Scots Folk Orchestra, and we were doing a wee show in Newton Ards, and we finished off the first half of our performance with doing a rendition on the lambegs and fifes, and then it just so happened that Dr. Paisley was in the audience. And so, because he was there, the people who were organising the event asked him to come up and say a few words at the break. So he comes onto the stage and he says, "Did you hear the music and that lambeg drum?" And some people say, "There's no music in it." That's because they cannot hear the music in it. For let me tell you this, only Protestant ears can hear the music and the lambeg drum. So that's maybe explains why not everybody appreciates, you know. So I'm going to play a wee blare here on the lambeg. I usually have fifers or sometimes even bagpipers to accompany, but you just have to use your imagination and hear the wee tune in your head.
Okay, we have a new guest this week on Radio Free Northwest. This is a young man calling himself Aristotle Darwin. I have no idea who he is or where he's from, but he wants to say a few words to us. I'm not sure how he made this recording. He made it in a slightly different format, and I had to convert it to MP3, and that may be the cause of a hum that you will hear in the background. I'm playing this largely because it's good to hear from someone under 50 years of age. His comments are pretty standard, but at least it's clear he's been paying attention.
We've already won. They own the media, every television show, movie, newspaper, and most online news is controlled and or approved by their influence. The Congress and politicians are owned through AIPAC, Project for the New American Century, bribes, campaign contributions, insider trading, etc. 98% of professors in universities are Democrats. Inferior hordes of infiltrators pour across our borders every day by the thousands. As I speak, politicians are going to the southern frontier to welcome the infiltrators with open arms. The stock market climbs higher and higher every day as the economy crumbles through fiat money printing. Everything points toward despair and loss, yet we've already won. Right Sector, Swedish Democrats, United Kingdom Independence Party, National Front, Jobbik, Tea Party are all rising as the European peoples grow angrier at what is being done to them. People are buying guns at rates of tens of millions per year. Silver and gold sales are growing every year. Television viewership is wavering and decreasing as individuals grow tired of the degeneracy and depravity being encouraged. The European people are salivating for war, only this time it won't be against each other. This may be the last chance we ever have of saving ourselves from extinction. They are scared and preparing for what yet is to come. What is to come within the next couple of years? Nobody knows. But one thing is for sure. War is on the horizon. Instead of being angry about the betrayal of politicians, smile. Every law banning criticism of the Muslim immigration in Sweden wins us another friend. Every folly and unpunished law-breaking of our rulers gains us another convert. Every silver coin you buy is another brick being toppled over in the faltering stock market. Victory is already ours. Anger is not a valid emotion at this stage. Anger will come when people are starving and being kicked out of their homes. Right now is the stage of laughter and preparation. Every multiracial society throughout history has failed, from Yugoslavia to Sudan to the Soviet Union to Iraq. Right now as we speak, the Shia south of Iraq is being propped up from Iranian guns and soldiers. The Sunni northwest is being conquered by 10,000 soldiers who are willing to fight and die for their cause. Northeast is being held by the Kurds. How many soldiers will finally have had enough at the loss of Iraq to those who supported in Afghanistan and Syria? The American loss of Iraq is another victory for us. As you see loss, I see victory.
Okay, here's Andy with this week's Real Politics installment, and I'd like to point out that the musical closing of his segment this week was added on at his request. He seems to feel it's appropriate to this week's topic.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. As promised, I'm now going to respond to remarks made to the party as far back as the beginning of the year regarding capitalism and libertarianism. These issues were brought to our attention in a specific manner on the party message board, and while I did give a short response at the time, I did so only to indicate I would later return to the matter in these Real Politics talks. One might wonder why I didn't bother to just answer the question and move on. And once again, I must return to the reason I'm delivering these lectures. White nationalists of all sorts are almost completely unable, with very few exceptions, of making rational, responsible, and effective political choices. This is almost always due to a detachment from the basics, usually by way of ignoring race. To recap, because of communism's racial nature, which attempts to reverse biology and make everyone equal, it isn't compatible with racial nationalism, which accepts biological reality and attempts to conform to it. The idea of combining them both into a nationalist type of communism is absolutely contradictory. In fact, I suspect the people who first suggested it were trying to start a joke and see how far it would go, as it's very difficult to think any racist could be serious about Bolshevism. But what else isn't racially healthy? And more importantly, what would someone be likely to carry over from their pre-racist political alignment? My personal anecdote from last time I did RFN shows that anyone and everyone can have political baggage they need to work through. I won't take someone to task for having such political baggage as I would with a long-term white nationalist who doesn't understand the Jew. An entire childhood and part of an adult life under the current order is going to partially ruin anyone's mind, and due to my own experience, I have a healthy understanding of the work a person has to do to overcome it. It took me years of serious political involvement to get to the point where I could no longer avoid the race issue, and after that, it took me a massive amount of reading in the year between finding the party and coming home to start understanding race and how it affects political theory. If it's not becoming painfully obvious where I'm going with this, my intent today is to cover statements and opinions I don't agree with in an effort to help reinforce the point I made when I covered communism. Because this is a special case where the person made certain remarks in public and knows I'm addressing them specifically, I feel the need to emphasize I'm not trying to single him out for correction. With all that out of the way, I'll start off light with a simple example to further illustrate how this sort of thing should work. The son of a comrade I met in the year it took me to come home approached me some time ago with the prospect of national libertarianism. Is libertarianism racially healthy? Well, no. It's perfectly all right for the government to restrict, at the very least, who is allowed into a country. Remember, white genocide is caused by the physical proximity of the races. So right there, the government is definitely in someone's business. Further, it's also perfectly all right to demand that the white people living in said country not copulate with other races. Again, to prevent white genocide. In a nationalist society, it's perfectly all right for the government to restrict people's behavior. I can imagine someone thinking everything else which isn't explicitly racial being none of the government's business. But again, this isn't consistent with racial reality. Strictly speaking, since race is perhaps the most fundamental aspect of human existence, it affects everything. I'm not going so far as to suggest that an ethnostate needs to limit every single action in their society. However, an economy also has a racial component to it even after non-whites have been removed from the population. Just as communism is an invention of the Jew, other economic philosophies have elements to them which aren't acceptable in a racially conscious society. I know this might be a little boring for some of you, but it really does matter. Either we're going to fully embrace racial reality and base our thoughts, decisions, and actions on the basic facts I've covered, or we're not. This material isn't mine originally, and in all but the most obscure cases, it's actually common knowledge. There's no excuse for it not to be treated as such. A different member of the party message board than the man I'm addressing today passed along a remark from someone he encountered on Stormfront. This person is apparently not a white nationalist, white separatist, or anything of the sort. They just happen to hang around white nationalist websites because they want things to be like they were 30 years ago. I understand that, but it's also wrong. 30 years ago, white genocide was just as bad as it is now because the long-term situation was already in place. This is the whole turn-back-the-clock canard. This begs an interesting question, though. Exactly what about 30 years ago was so wonderful? Well, I can't speak about details in the rest of the world during the early to mid-80s, but America happened to enter a period of massive economic expansion right then. Remember what I said about economics and other issues. It's perfectly fine to worry about them since they're what caused most of us to become interested in racism in the first place. But they're not the end-all, be-all of politics. People tend to feel a lot better when they're in a good place economically, but like I said, our current cycle of white genocide was in full swing while people were celebrating their newfound economic security. Reliving the past doesn't hold any hope for us. I've dithered around for a while without actually getting to my point, so I'd better cut myself off. I don't have time here to quote everything word for word, so I'll cover themes. Quote, "The main issue I see with America is that whites simply lost the freedom of association." End quote. Okay, firstly, I note we're dealing with something that is purported to be a constitutional civil right. Sorry, civil right. I'll come back to that in a second, but the substance of the idea itself needs to be dealt with first. While a perfectly valid point, it's not actually germane to the racial struggle. Never forget the problem is proximity, not socialization. Now, as for the legal issue involved. Firstly, I'm sure that all sorts of previous white civilizations had all sorts of laws saying what people should have been allowed to do. None of those seem to have helped them out, and the people who came up with those laws have non-white descendants. Always remember that. Secondly, on the specific issue of American civil rights, we need to remember that America itself has suffered such demographic damage that it's not capable of being salvaged as a whole. Appealing to something like the American Constitution as an authority is, at this point, not operable. Remember RealPolitics 1 on the Constitution of the United States. It's not holy writ, and it's not even a reasonable attempt at government. It's a last-ditch effort to cobble something together as a fallback after a failed attempt at a monarchy. I've probably crossed a few of you with my remarks on the subject, but I'm right and you're wrong. So there. In the same message board post, this person also mentioned they prefer anarcho-capitalism and believe it would, quote, align us well with libertarians, conservatives, and maybe a few with lefty tendencies, end quote. Well, as I've pointed out, nationalism isn't exactly a libertarian enterprise. Quite a while ago, I gave a talk on the whole left versus right thing, and noted they're not remotely on the same page about race. I don't think the NF wants to be aligned with lefties. The most interesting aspect of this remark, however, is the reference to conservatism, which indicates we're looking at an avoidance of race in favor of economics and government policy fixes. Remember what Commander Rockwell said about conservatives. They're out to protect their money, not their race. There's a definite trend in the remarks being made, and it's not one I'm exactly thrilled with. Capitalism is frequently confused with a free market, and it isn't any such thing. Commander Rockwell was a National Socialist, of course, but it's important to remember two things. First, the NF doesn't push National Socialism specifically, and second, National Socialist Germany had free markets and private property along with a racial type of socialism. They're not at all a contradiction, but that's a hard thing to convince Americans of. Capitalism, as almost all of you are aware, is a private sector version of communism, and therefore is just as dangerous. Capitalism means the people with the money make the rules. Capitalism is just as abusive of people as communism because it's just as Jewish. Think about the people who have been the biggest capitalists in our societies and think about all of the parasitic, abusive, and destructive things they've done. Slavery, child labor, cheap third world labor, cruel conditions, and usury are just as capitalistic as anything else. Historically speaking, they're also Jewish. The free market concept of an economy doesn't rely on having massive control of society through a number of large corporations designed to keep people dependent on the approval of those corporations for their existence. I am fully aware that the fellow in question probably meant free market, but none of us should buy into the American lie that capitalism is the free market. A free market wouldn't care how much money you have, since it's more concerned with what value you provide to the rest of the economy. The last remark of his I'll bring up today is the statement that Americans are, quote, very receptive to the libertarian message of freedom, and that is the wedge we need to move into politics with, end quote. Americans may be open to libertarianism as a reaction to the world around them, but that's not going to get them anywhere. It's just an attempt at turning the clock back to the point where they didn't feel personally threatened and had enough money lying around to pretend racial issues don't exist. Capitalism is great when you're the one raking in the dough, but remember it's as parasitic as the Jews who created it, and it literally eats the actual economy in order to deliver a bit of artificial value. There's nothing wrong with enterprising individuals concerning themselves with their wealth. but using a purely economic approach illustrates that racial reality hasn't permeated someone's thinking like it should. As with communism, someone's pre-racial understanding of capitalism should have been updated to comply with what's good for the race. Material wealth is absolutely fine, but we can't use it as a measure of success like a conservative or a capitalist would. Their one aim is money at any cost, and this is a large part of what caused our current situation. Using an economic solution on a racial problem just isn't good enough. Most Americans are, in fact, still receptive to an economic or anti-government message because they're only interested in making the system work for them personally. America, due to the Jews who run it, has become obsessed with building society around the acquisition of piles of cash, and little else. I've repeatedly said the first step in fixing our character is to stop being American. Today's reason for this is that Americans are still bewitched by materialism. I genuinely hope you can all say that you're free of the power of gold. Hail victory, comrades.
If you've ever seen any documentaries or newsreel footage or whatever of the trouble in Northern Ireland, you will have seen that they've got these big, huge wall murals on the walls of houses and buildings in the various Catholic and Protestant areas of places like Belfast and Derry. I remember I used to see a really big one coming through Strabane on my way through the north when I was taking the bus up from Dublin to Donegal. And depending on what kind of neighborhood it is, the wall murals will either be celebrating the heroes of the 1916 rebellion or the 10 hunger strikers from 1981. But in the Protestant areas, the big hero is always King William of Orange, King Billy as he's called, who defeated the Catholics in 1690 at the Battle of the Boyne. I forget who does this, but the song is called King Billy's on the Wall.
There's a famous painting now that everybody knows. It stands upon a gable wall over Sandy Road, in memory of King William and Brotherhood is joined. They fought for our deliverance at the Battle of the Boyne. King Billy's on the wall, King Billy's on the wall. He stands so high, shines so bright, he lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him, they stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1690, King Billy's on the wall. Well, there are slogans painted in red, white, and blue. They tell the Pope where he can go and what he can do. There's one big Jared Rice, well, that's a different class. Go stick the lower armor on and stick it up your ass. King Billy's on the wall, King Billy's on the wall. He stands so high, he shines so bright, he lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him, they stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1619, King Billy's on the wall. Well, the next time you're an Ulster, won't you come and have a look? Stand beside that mural and have your photo too. then put it on your mantelpiece or hang it in your hall, so that all the world can see King Pele's on the wall. King Pele's on the wall, King Pele's on the wall. He stands so high, he shines so bright, he lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him, they stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1690, King Pele's on the wall. King Pele's on the wall, King Pele's on the wall. He stands so high, he shines so bright, he lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him, they stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1690, King Pele's on the wall. He lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him, they stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1690, King Pele's on the wall.
Right, I'm going to be starting a new series here on Radio Free Northwest, maybe not every week, but every couple of weeks at least, called Qui Custode Ipsos Custodes, Who Guards the Guardians. And in this series, I'm going to be discussing the various foibles, eccentricities, atrocities, and monumental fuck-ups of the muscle men who make Obama possible. I mean, these guys claim to be so much better and smarter than everybody else, and of course so big and bad and tough, and we're all just so scared of them. And if you don't believe me, watch Bones and Criminal Minds and NCIS, all that kind of Hollywood claptrap. Well, let's take a look. Let's see just how big and bad and tough and smart they are in real life. First up this week, you guessed it, are those silk-suited boys and girls in the black SUVs and the airport rental cars themselves. The mighty FBI.
There's a man who leads a life of danger. Everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. Another chance he takes. He odds are he won't live to see tomorrow. Secret agent man, secret agent man. They've given you a number. I know they take away your
dreams. And you FBI guys who are listening, can be thankful that I didn't make the theme song in this segment, Along Comes Mary. I thought about it, but the fact is that, although I never thought I'd say this, I miss J. Edgar Hoover and the way he ran the Bureau. Now, personally, John Edgar was a revolting human being, like you could get anyone else in the top job at the FBI. He was a transvestite faggot who made his catamite an assistant director and used to dress up in women's clothes and go nightclubbing in New York, calling himself Mary, by the way, for all you younger people out there who are not from my time and who don't get the joke. Apparently, he and Clyde Tolson were regular patrons of the Stork Club as a couple, only sometimes it was Tolson being there with John, and sometimes he was with Mary. Everybody knew. It was one of the worst-kept secrets in government, but nobody dared to say anything until after Hoover was dead. But I have to give the man his props. The fact is that, as a law enforcement officer, he was infinitely superior to any of the political hacks and ideological sock puppets for the regime who've held the office since then. He was a stickler for civil liberties. He was the only man in the country who dared to stand up even a little bit to evil people like Franklin Roosevelt, Eleanor Roosevelt, the Kennedys, Martin Luther King, and he was sufficiently successful as a backroom political operator so that I think when all is said and done, it can legitimately be said it's at least possible that our long, lovely post-war Indian summer from 1945 to about 1974 or so, when the final episode of the Brady Bunch aired, that time was in part his doing. You know, that wonderful time that some of us are old enough to remember. The time when white people and families lived in houses, not rented apartments and double-wide mobile homes. The time of abundance and relative peace and prosperity and real rock and roll. The time when this country wasn't an open-air insane asylum with overflowing toilets and wallowing in perversion and political correctness. Some of that golden time was down to John Edgar, I think. With his secret files and his blackmail and his wiretaps and his juice on Capitol Hill, J. Edgar Hoover kept the madness at bay for a long time. And I thank him for that. Above all, Hoover kept his men in line, and he didn't let them run roughshod over the American people or ignore the law. He was extremely careful who he recruited. You know that in Hoover's day, the only people who could apply to join the Bureau as agents had to have either a law degree or be a CPA, a certified public accountant. That's for work on tax cases and white-collar crime, that sort of stuff. No more. After Hoover came a whole new crop of FBI agents, men and women who were and are, to all intents and purposes, criminals themselves. Men like Supervisory Special Agent John Connolly, come on down. Now, Connolly was an Irish kid from Boston who grew up in Southie, one of those old ethnic neighborhoods where boys grew up to be one of three things, a hoodlum, a cop, or a priest. Now, far from being a lawyer, Connolly flunked out of Suffolk University Law School, and he got his FBI job due to a letter of recommendation written to U.S. House Speaker John McCormick, who was another Irish Democrat, as corrupt as the day is long, in the best Mayor Daley tradition. Anyway, the letter was written by Massachusetts State Representative Billy Bulger, the brother of James Whitey Bulger, who was the boss of the Winter Hill Gang in Southie, otherwise known as the Irish Mob. Now, on August the 1st, 1968, U.S. Speaker McCormick wrote a personal note to J. Edgar Hoover, which said as follows. Dear Edgar, it has come to my attention that the son of a lifelong personal friend has applied to become a special agent of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, blah, blah, blah. Hoover, I guess, owed McCormick a favor. Hey, look, I never said the guy was perfect. Washington exists on the exchange of favors, even more so than the mafia does. And in this case, Hoover's usually rigorous recruiting standards slipped. John Connolly was appointed to the FBI in October of 1968. Now, during his early years, Connolly did a lot of moving around. Baltimore, San Francisco, New York City. Now, this is pretty standard for new FBI agents. In 1973, he again seems to have used his political connections to get sent to Boston. And there he stayed for the rest of his career, and that was unusual. It's a rare FBI agent who gets to spend almost his entire working life in one place. This evidently is one reason why the silk suits in Spokane were so eager to conjure up some more white racist terrorism here in the Northwest, to the point where they fabricated evidence against Edgar Steele. Now, some of them were about to be reassigned, and they didn't want to leave the nice white Northwest for urban shitholes like Detroit and Los Angeles. Anyway, long story short, getting back to what I was talking about, John Connolly got himself assigned to investigating organized crime, which in Boston meant either the actual Italian mafia in North End or the Irish mob in Southie. Now, Connolly gets this bright idea. Why not use the Irish mob as informants to destroy the Italians? And then later on, he gets another bright idea. Why not use the Irish mob to just kill the Italians? And so he did. Connolly was one of the primary agents involved in developing the top echelon criminal informants program in New England. Now, since Connolly had grown up with guys like Whitey Bulger and Steve the Rifleman Fleming and John Martirano, who, in spite of their Italian names, were actually affiliated with the Irish Winter Hill Gang, who better to recruit such top echelon informants? Now, the trouble is, the mobsters seem to have recruited him as their top echelon informant within the FBI. Okay, the John Connolly story is sufficiently well known. Movies and TV shows have been made about it, including at least one episode of Law and Order, so I don't need to spend too much time on the details. Basically, over the years, the FBI agent in charge of investigating organized crime in Boston became a mole for the mob. One mob, anyway, and it reached the point where Connolly was not only ignoring Bulger and Fleming's greatest hits, he was actually participating as a conspirator in gangland rubouts. And not just Italian mafiosi, either. What he was doing was helping the Winter Hill guys get rid of people that they wanted gotten rid of for various financial and personal reasons. Okay, let's cut to the chase. John Connolly's corruption and his involvement with the mob became so notorious and stank so badly to high heaven that eventually even the federal government of the United States could no longer ignore it. And that says a lot about how rotten this bastard was, that even a totally corrupt community like the federal government can't tolerate him and has to vomit him out. Now, beginning in the mid-1990s, Connolly was indicted for all kinds of bribery and corruption charges, and also on murder and conspiracy to commit murder charges in the 1982 mob slaying of certified public accountant John B. Callahan, and in the 1981 gangland murder of Roger Wheeler, owner of the World Hi-Li Sporting Corporation. Basically, Connolly used FBI resources to track down and target people for assassination by Bulger and Fleming. He was convicted, and he is still in prison. A senior United States attorney and a senior federal judge testified at his trial as character witnesses. Now, that rumbling you hear is J. Edgar Hoover turning over in his grave in his patent leather pumps. Now, the hell of it is that all the time John Connolly was hobnobbing with his Irish mob buddies and planning criminal activity with them, which was over the span of many years, Special Agent Connolly received 8 commendations from every director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, from J. Edgar Hoover himself, L. Patrick Gray, William Ruckelshaus, Clarence M. Kelly, James B. Adams, William H. Webster, John Otto, and William S. Sessions. You know, the one with the bitchy wife who tried to take over the FBI. FBI Agent Connolly was even married into the mob. His brother-in-law was a guy named Arthur Gianelli, who was later indicted with Joey Y. Girardi. And Girardi oversaw John Martorano's criminal operations when he was a federal fugitive in Florida between 1978 and 1995. Now, that's 18 years that the mighty FBI couldn't find this guy. I wonder why. I mean, could he possibly have had some help from someone inside the bureau? Oh, no, 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 that would never happen. I mean, those FBI guys, they're just straight shooters. They would never become involved in something like that. Oh, no, I mean, don't you watch Criminal Minds or Bones? In 1989, Connolly corrupted and headed off a DEA investigation into the Winter Hill Gang for drug trafficking. Now, Connolly's former roommate and John's brother James both worked for the DEA. As an FBI supervisor later noted in a memo, the head of the DEA's Boston office quietly changed the duties of both of these DEA special agents so that they would not become aware of this matter, i.e. the DEA investigation into the Irish mob. So, in other words, as early as 1989, other federal law enforcement agencies were aware of the fact that the FBI had a bad apple in Boston, and nothing was done. To quote a former supervisor, Connolly just became a force unto himself, a vortex in a constantly changing system. He stayed put as new agents in charge came and went. And he could take care of other agents. He became the guy who could get you sports tickets. He could help you get a day off through the secretaries. He made no secret that he could help you get a job after retirement through Billy Bulger, and that's the gangster Whitey Bulger's brother, who was a big wheel in Massachusetts state politics for about 30 years. Democrat, of course. I'm going back to the quote now from Connolly's former supervisor. But he wasn't that much of an agent. He couldn't write a report. He was no administrator. He was just this brassy bullshit artist. We enabled him to some extent. No one had the stomach for examining what he was up to. We just never came to grips with that guy. Well, there you have it, folks. Never mind Bones. Never mind Criminal Minds. Never mind Silence of the Lambs. Celie Booth and Clarice Starling and the bold boys and girls of the BAU are Hollywood bullshit. They don't exist. Special Agent John Connolly is the reality. a liar, a bullshit artist, a traitor, and a murderer. John Connolly is the true face of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Oh, one more thing. In 1990, after Connolly retired from the FBI, Billy Bulger lobbied the Boston Mayor Ray Flynn to have Connolly appointed as Commissioner of the Boston Police Department.
Secret agent man, secret agent man, they've given you a number, oh, they've taken away.
Now you know that every glorious 12th, I just gotta play this one. This is Makeham and Clancy.
Thank you. Seeing as it's near the 17th of March, we're going to extend a hand to our orange brethren. With a black spot on it. You see, in the north of Ireland, we have a bunch of fellas called orange men, and they're fellas that sell oranges. Lemons. Now, this fella in our hometown, he was an orange man, and he was going with this girl. She was a Catholic. They're the bad fellas, and we're the good fellas. And they decided to get married, so they got married, and after we were married a little while, he decided he was going to become a Catholic. So he went to the priest and he took instructions for a long time, and he was baptized eventually. And he came home, but he couldn't get it through his head that he was a Catholic, and he didn't know what the hell to do about it. So he went to the priest and he said, "Now look, Father," he said, "I know I took all them instructions and you baptized me and everything, but I can't get through my head that I'm a Catholic. What'll I do about it?" So the priest says, "Well, see Norman Vincent Peale." No, he didn't say that. He said, "The only thing I can tell you to do is keep repeating to yourself, 'I'm a Catholic, I'm not a Protestant, I'm a Catholic, I'm not a Protestant, I'm a Catholic, I'm not a Protestant, I'm a Catholic, I'm not a Protestant.' Eventually it'll penetrate your thick skull that you're a Catholic, you're not a Protestant." So away he went muttering to himself, "I'm a Catholic, I'm not a Protestant, I'm a Catholic, I'm not a Protestant, I'm a Catholic, I'm not a Protestant." Now, the following Friday, the priest happened to be going around and he decided to visit the newlyweds. And he went in and he got a whiff he shouldn't get in a good Catholic house on a Friday. And Mary was sitting knitting and he says to her, "Where's Sam, Mary?" He said, "He's in the kitchen, Father." So he walked into the kitchen and there was Sam, and he had a huge big steak on the pan and he was scooping gravy over it and he said, "You're a trout, you're not a steak, you're a trout, you're not a steak, you're a trout." The song is called "You're a Trout, You're Not a Steak." No, it's called "The Old Orange Flute." A fish. In the county Tyrone, near the town of Dungannon, where Manny's eruption, myself had a hand in, Bob Williamson lived, however betrayed, and all of us thought him a stout orange blade. On the 12th of July, as it yearly did come, Bob played with his flute to the sound of a drum. You may talk of your harp, your piano, or lute, but there's none could compare with the old orange flute. But Bob the Deceiver, he took us all in. He married a papist called Bridget McGinn, turned papish himself and forsook the old cause that gave us our freedom, religion and laws. Now the boys of the place made some comment upon it, and Bob had to fly to the province of Connaught. He fled with his wife and his fixings to boot, and along with the latter, his old orange flute. At the chapel on Sunday to atone for past deeds, said pathers and aves and counted his beads, till after some time at the priest's own desire, he went with the old flute to play in the choir. He went with the old flute to play for the mass, but the instrument shivered and sighed, oh alas. And try though he would, though it made a great noise, the flute would play only the Protestant boys. Bob Junkton, he started and got in a flutter, and threw the old flute in the blessed holy water. He thought that this charm would bring some other sound. When he tried it again, it laid crappies lie down. And for all he would whistle and finger and blow to play Papish music, he found it no go. Kick the Pope and boil water, it freely would sound, but one Papish squeaking it couldn't be found. At the council of priests that was held the next day, they decided to banish the owl flute away. They couldn't knock heresy out of its head, so they bought Bob a new one to play in its stead. Well, the owl flute was doomed, and its fate was pathetic. 'Twas fastened and burned at the stake as heretic. As the flame soared around it, they heard a strange noise, as the owl flute still whistled in the Protestant voice.
Toodle-a-lee, toodle-a-lee, all of it 6 miles from Bangor to Donaghadee.
Right, we'll close this week with a few housekeeping notes. First off, summer is the season for scouting trips. Now, for those among you who doubt that anything is happening with our Northwest migration, just FYI, right at this moment there are not one, not two, but three, count them, three new comrades rolling this way across the fruited plain toward the Northwest. Or in one case, a man and his wife are driving around Montana heading this way in a long, leisurely roll. And before next week is out, I should have met with at least two of these new folks, and I'll do my best to talk them into doing their duty to history and coming here to live the rest of their lives, sink their roots, and make a home in the homeland. Secondly, to the comrade in Chicago who sent me the samples of those large yellow postcard-type thingies, since your mailing address is now down and I'm having some trouble with your email, thank you very much indeed for those. They are truly well done, and I will take all of them that you care to send me. Thanks also for the envelope and its contents. Third, a belated welcome home again to Comrade Bruce in Oregon. He had to leave the homeland for a while due to a family medical emergency, but he's back again now, and I hope to see you soon. Fourth, our Colonel House Academy of Cinematic Arts seems to have wandered off the plantation again. Come on, guys, check back in and tell me you're ready to get back into the swing of things again and start making those YouTube videos. Finally, can some of you webheads out there who like to Google help me out here? For a future episode of Qui Custode Ipsos Custodes, Who Guards the Guardians, I am trying to do some research on a question that I think I know the answer to, but this is a case where multiple cooks will make a better broth. I need to track down and learn about any incident in the past 30 years or so where any federal law enforcement agency, be they FBI, ATF, Secret Service, whatever, actually went up against somebody who fought back. Now, by that, I mean somebody who was not taken by surprise in a dawn raid or while they were asleep or something. Someone who was not drunk or high on drugs or 75 years old. Someone who was not afraid of them and not afraid to act out on their lack of fear for the mighty men in the black body armor. Now, that crazy nigger Christopher Dorner doesn't count because the Leos he terrorized and drove insane with fear and paranoia weren't feds, they were LAPD. Likewise, the famous shootout between those hopped-up bank robbers a few years ago where they had the body armor and the drum magazine AKs. Now, I mean incidents where the feds were confronted by armed men who were not afraid of them and who had at least some general idea of what the hell they were doing. I want to do a comparison between the real world and the Hollywood movie and television version of these things and see how they stack up. Email me the links to any relevant websites or articles, please. But for now, our time is up. Looks like Godot still hasn't shown up, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha on the Bon. Freedom. Oh, hell, tell you what. Instead of my usual Southern Irish musical closing for this show, we'll go back up north again, and we'll sign off with a little lambeg. A little lambeg goes a long way.
We'll be right back.